We have been blessed here in the last roughly year and a half with a number of new babies. And of course, our family was blessed a little over a week ago with a new grandson, and the Watermans were just blessed yesterday with the arrival of some twins. So there's babies everywhere. And I love little children, and one of my favorite things, I think it's one of the most beautiful pictures of all, is seeing a newborn baby cuddling up with its mother. There is nothing more beautiful than that, and what I call it is a picture of contentment. Psalm 131 that was just read for us uses that image, the idea of a weaned child or perhaps a child recently nursed cuddling up against its mother as an image of contentment. And I think it's just a powerful picture. This is one of the shortest passages in the Bible. Psalm 117, Psalm 133, and Psalm 131 are three of the shortest passages in the Bible. And in this really short passage, it packs a punch. It takes one of the most simple illustrations that we see so often in life and uses it to make a powerful point about the concept of contentment. So I want to talk about David's imagery here of contentment with this little baby and make some applications to us. He says in Psalm 131, if you look at the heading, many of the Psalms, not all of them, but most of them, have some kind of a heading, and that always tells you a little bit of information about it. Some of the information is very helpful. Sometimes we kind of scratch our head and say, well, that's interesting. Here we're told that it's a song of ascents. There's some discussion over exactly what that means. The best guess seems to be that these are pilgrim psalms. There's a phrase that occurs a lot in the Bible, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. When people would travel to Israel, it says they were going up to Jerusalem. Now, some of that was geographic because Jerusalem was situated on a ridge in hilly territory. So there was literally going up to it, but I think even more there was the importance of the city. You go up to this great city because that's where the tabernacle and later the temple were at. And the theory is that these psalms of ascent that we read here in the book of Psalms, they start with Psalm number 120 and they go down through Psalm 134. There's this cluster of about 15 psalms that we call songs of ascent. As pilgrims would ascend to Jerusalem during the annual festivals, they would sing these songs as a way of recounting their pilgrimage in life by singing these in their pilgrimage to Jerusalem. And I think that's probably the best explanation. We're also told this is a psalm of David. That little phrase in the Hebrew is La David. And David, of course, is the word for David. And then there's this little preposition in front of it. Most of the time, it probably just indicates the authorship. Who wrote this psalm? Most likely David. There's a few places where we're not exactly sure if that's what it means or not, but probably the best guess is that David wrote this at some point in his distinguished career. There's nothing in the context that indicates what the occasion was. There might be a little bit of indication from something that's said in verse 3, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. It is what we would call a psalm of trust. There's a lot of elements that are missing. There's not really praise here like you might see in the last few psalms in the book of Psalms. There's not really a statement of thanksgiving. Obviously, he begins by addressing the Lord. But more than anything, the psalm is just emphasizing the trust and the confidence that David has in his condition in the Lord. And he extends that to his fellow Israelites in verse 3. Also, it has a little bit of affinity with the psalm right before it. If you'll notice in verse 3 of Psalm 131, it says, O hope in the Lord from this time forth and forevermore, and it, which is almost identical to the opening of verse 7 in Psalm 130, O Israel, hope in the Lord. So they have a couple of affinities there. And someone has suggested that verses 5 and 6 of Psalm 130, where David says, I wait for the Lord, my soul waits, and in His word I hope. My soul waits for the Lord more than the watchman for the morning, more than the watchman for the morning. Someone has suggested that there in verses 5 and 6, what you have in Psalm 131 is the embodiment of those two verses, where David talks about just resting in the Lord and finding confidence and comfort. So there's a little bit of a relationship between those two. So I want us to look at this psalm and see what David has to tell us about this childlike confidence and childlike assurance and contentment that we can have in our relationship to the Lord. He starts out by talking about his humility. Now, this is pretty typical in the Psalms. The psalmist wants to describe something, and he describes it in a negative way. The basic point in verse 1 is he addresses God, and he confesses his humility. But he confesses his humility to God by saying, I'm not this. And that's, as I said, a fairly common way of doing things in the psalm. The psalmist will describe something by telling you about it in a negative way. So he starts out with a threefold description of what he's not. And so in verse 1, he says, O Lord, my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not raised too high, I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me. So my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not raised too high, and I don't occupy myself with big stuff. So that's his negative description of his humility. Now, he starts out with, I think, the proper place. He talks about his heart, and he says, my heart is not proud. Literally, in the Hebrew, the word order is, not proud is my heart. The emphasis is on that word, pride. He lacks total, any kind of pride, any vestige of pride whatsoever. And he says it originates in the heart. That's where everything originates. And I think it's interesting that he starts this psalm by describing it in that way. Pride originates in the heart, as does humility. All sins originate in the heart, as do all acts of righteousness. Things that originate in the heart have a way of expressing themselves outwardly. And he starts out simply by saying, my heart is not full of pride. There's a lot of places where that word is used to describe some people who suffered from pride. King Uzziah, if you go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 26, the same word is used there to describe King Uzziah and his struggle with pride. 2 Chronicles 26 in verse 16, but when he was strong, he grew proud to his destruction, for he was unfaithful to the Lord his God and entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. It gives us one illustration of his pride. Uzziah could have been a great man, and he was in many regards, but with the success that he enjoyed from God, that became a source of pride for him, which ultimately became a source of sin and a source of his downfall. The same word is used even of King Hezekiah in 2 Chronicles chapter 32. Hezekiah, likewise, was a great man. He was a godly man in so many ways, and yet he struggled with that. 2 Chronicles 32, verse 25, but Hezekiah did not make return according to the benefit done to him, for his heart was proud. Therefore wrath came upon him and Judah and Jerusalem. So he struggled with pride. And there were times that David struggled with pride. I don't know if this psalm was written before his sin with Bathsheba or afterward. But David at times exhibited a remarkable humility, especially I think early in his career. He exhibited a remarkable capacity for humility. And so he starts out then with this emphasis on his lack of pride. The sin that he's addressing is pride. The emphasis here is on the attitude that produces it. The second thing he talks about in verse 1, he says, not proud is my heart, and not haughty are my eyes. The idea of lifting up the eyes. I think that's a remarkable insight into how we humans do things. Our body language is capable of expressing all kinds of attitudes. And sometimes, you know, we say that eyes are the windows of the soul. You can look at a person's eyes and sometimes get an idea of what they think about themselves. And he's talking here about someone who just kind of has a very high view of themselves. Someone who has a very haughty view of themselves. The sin here is presumptuousness. And the emphasis here is upon the carnal, worldly ambitions that we sometimes exhibit. Lifting up the eyes isn't necessarily a bad thing if we're lifting them up for the right reasons. Psalm 121 begins by saying, I lift up my eyes to the hills. From whence comes my help? My help comes from the Lord. In that case, the lifting up of the eyes is a good thing. But in the sense that David is talking about, The Bible presents that actually as an abomination before God. In Proverbs chapter 6, Proverbs chapter 6 in verse 17, or verse 16, there are six things that the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination to Him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, and feet that make haste to run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among brothers. The first thing on this list of seven things that God absolutely abhors, first thing on the list is haughty eyes. The eyes can express sometimes the contempt that we have toward others. Pride takes on a couple of different manifestations. Sometimes pride is an overly high opinion of yourself, but pride also takes a form where you have an understated view of others. You think too much of yourself, or you think too little of others. And it creates in us a contempt toward other people. And so David says, my heart isn't proud and my eyes are not lofty. My eyes have not been lifted up. I'm not looking down my nose at other people. And then the third way of expressing his lack of pride in this verse, he says, nor am I walking in great things, in things too difficult for me. And again, in the Hebrew text, not walking am I in great things and in difficulties. The word great things there, now first of all, the word walk is interesting because he's gone now from attitudes to actions. He's gone from the attitude of pride and the ambition that comes when we have the wrong attitude about ourselves and others, and now he's talking about the day-to-day actions. Walking is a metaphor that occurs frequently in the Bible. It reflects our lifestyle. And so he says, I do not walk in certain things. The two things he describes here are great things and difficulties. The word great things is normally used in the Old Testament to describe the great works of God. And what he's saying is, I don't dabble in things that are beyond me. I don't do things that I'm just not capable of doing. Again, the emphasis here is on the actions. Have you ever known somebody who just seems kind of self-absorbed in what they're doing? You talk to them, oh, I'm just so busy. I'm just so busy. I don't have time to talk to you right now. I just got so much to do. And you start pressing them, well, you just wouldn't understand. It's this mentality that I'm just involved in all these great things, and lesser people just don't get it. And he says, that's not me. And you think about this. This is David the king. He's running an empire. He's running a kingdom. And David says, I'm not dabbling in big stuff here. He said, that stuff is beyond me. These are great works. So there's an emphasis here even on how pride can affect our actions. So in three ways, David says, I'm trying to be humble. He says, I'm not proud in my heart. I'm not haughty in my eyes. And I'm not dabbling in things that are beyond my difficulty. So here there are three sins: pride, presumptuousness, and pretentiousness, that reflect three different attitudes, or reflect three other things: attitudes and ambitions and actions. So he starts out in a negative way by saying, Lord, I'm trying to be as humble as I can by removing these things from me. And then in verse 2, he now flips over to a different aspect. He says, but I have calmed and quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother, like a weaned child is my soul within me. Most of the English translations have something like the word but at the beginning of verse 2, and it's actually the same word that was used three times in verse 1. Three times in verse 1 you have the Hebrew word lo, which is no or not proud, not haughty, not walking am I. This is the same word. So no, rather, instead of these things in verse 1, instead, in place of this, he says, I have calmed and quieted my soul. Some translations say, I have composed myself. And the word here just means level, like a field. It's used in Isaiah when it speaks about God leveling things when the Messiah comes. He would level the ground. He would take the hills and make them and flatten them out. He would take the valleys and raise them up. And he says, I've leveled everything. I don't have any disquiet in my soul. I don't have any bumps along the way. And he says, not only that, but I have quieted my soul. And the word that's used here is the word for silence or being mute. He says, I have nothing to say. I am so content, I'm just here. There's no bumps on the road. I don't have to say anything. There's no comment. Completely composed and quieted in every way. And then twice, he says, I'm like a weaned child. Now, there's a couple of different images that could be used here. He may be talking just about an infant who was just nursed. And you know the kind of appetite that infants have. They have these voracious appetites, and when they are hungry, they want everybody to know about it. But as soon as you feed them, as soon as they're full, they're happy, they're content, and you don't hear a peep from them. That's when they snuggle up against mama and they're ready to go to sleep. So it may be describing an infant who was just fed, or it may just be describing a weaned child. A child who has been weaned realizes, you know, that's hard sometimes to wean some children. They are so attached to mom. They don't want to let go. They don't think there's anything better than mother and her milk. Now, most of our kids, once we introduced them to real food, they were fine. They off the bottle, they off mama. They liked real food. But with some babies, that's a hard thing to get them to detach from mom. And that's what he's describing here. A child who has been weaned, a child who realizes, okay, I don't have to have mama. I have everything I need. I'm quiet. I can sit here in mom's lap. I can snuggle up against mom. And I don't feel this need to be upset. There's not this need to be crying. There's not this need because they have been weaned from mother. And so that may be more the idea here. But in either case, he's describing his contentment. Now, we need to understand the connection between verses 1 and 2. In verse 1 and 2, again, he's describing these attitudes that you have to get rid of if you want to have the attitude of verse 2. You cannot have the contentment in verse 2 without getting rid of the things in verse 1. Without removing those spiritual impediments, those wrong ideas and wrong attitudes, you can't have contentment. Contentment is impossible when certain things are there in your heart, in your mind, and in your life. And that's the connection between verse 1 and 2. Lord, I have gotten rid of these things, verse 1, so that I can have this kind of contentment that he's describing there in verse 2. Pride keeps us from being able to be content. It's interesting how the Bible defines contentment in different ways. When you look at the New Testament, the primary emphasis on contentment is contentment with material goods. Paul uses it that way in Philippians chapter 4. John the Baptist, when Roman soldiers came and heard him preach, they said, well, what do we do to repent? And he said, you need to be content with your wages. Paul in 1 Timothy says, if we have food and raiment, we shall be therewith content. The emphasis on contentment in the New Testament is contentment with material things. There's one place, and that's in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, we looked at, I think, a couple of weeks ago. We talked about joy and strength, even when we have bad health. The idea there is that Paul uses the word content, not just to describe material things, but rather to describe health and crisis and things like that. He could be content in those circumstances. But the emphasis is on material things. Here, I think what David is describing is a little bit more comprehensive. It's contentment under any set of circumstances, contentment under any set of disquieting circumstances. And without that contentment, we can't have really the right relationship with God. Contentment reflects to a degree our faith in God. And sometimes pride is the biggest barrier to that. We puff ourselves up. We have these enormous egos. We think that we get it at a level that nobody else does. We think we are so important in so many ways. And we can have that mentality toward other people. We can have that mentality toward our families. We can have that mentality toward the church. We can have all kinds of pride issues. One of the more interesting comments I read when I was studying this psalm, John Goldengay made the comment, the difference between God and us is that God doesn't think he's us. Absolutely. We like to think we're a whole lot more like God than sometimes we actually are. And we like to think we're like God in the sense that we are in control. And if it wasn't for me, and you just fill in the blanks, all kinds of catastrophes would follow. Pride gets in the way. And it prevents us not only from being content, but it also prevents us from having a proper foundation in God that allows us to have that kind of contentment. Now, David also extends this to Israel. David's invitation is in verse 3. He shifts from himself to Israel. O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time forth and forevermore. Now, as I said at the beginning, there's not really any contextual clues in Psalm 131. What were the circumstances under which David wrote this? I really have no idea. The text doesn't supply anything. Verse 3, however, makes me wonder if there is not some national crisis at hand. Maybe the nation was struggling in some particular way. And if that's the case, maybe this is later in David's reign when he's facing some kind of crisis that could potentially shake the contentment, the quietness of the nation. But what David does here in the psalm, he starts out in the first two verses by dealing with himself. I have experienced this kind of contentment. I experienced this contentment by getting rid of every vestige, every remnant of pride. And Israel, here's the application in verse 3. Israel, if you'll do the same, you can have this kind of contentment too. So he goes from the personal aspect of contentment to a national aspect. He goes from his past experiences where he has gotten rid of his pride. He has experienced in the past this contentment. And he moves now to the present situation of Israel, but he extends it even to the future. O Israel, hope in the Lord. Israel, put your trust in the Lord. Find this kind of contentment, not just now, but he says from now, from this time forth, and forevermore. He says, Israel, you can experience this kind of contentment. You can have it for all of your existence. But you got to get rid of certain things in order to have this kind of contentment and this kind of hope in God. Now, I want us to talk about how we apply this to ourselves. You think about contentment. You think about what it takes to have this kind of contentment. When I was thinking about just some applications of this, one of the things that struck me, when I look at commentaries, I always get amused at how different commentaries treat certain subjects. And one of the favorite things I enjoy when I'm studying the Psalms is looking at how different commentaries treat the Psalms. And one of the ways you can tell how they treat them is the titles. Most commentary titles are pretty bland. And when they're dealing with certain texts, the titles are thrilling. For example, Derek Kidner's commentary describes Psalm 131, the childlike spirit, okay? And then Craig Broyle's commentary describes this as the quieted soul. And then you have Leslie Allen's commentary. He describes Psalm 131 as childlikeness. But here's my favorite. It's from John Goldengay's commentary. He says, how I gave up trying to fix things and so should you. And that is what Psalm 131 is about. That's the kind of contentment that we're dealing with. He's saying, we got to learn to be like kids. You know, kids aren't really great at fixing things, especially infants. They just trust. They have a problem, they go to mama. Once a year, they go to daddy. That's when mom's gone. Children trust mama. And when they have a problem, that's what they know to do. They don't go out and try to fix it. They don't go out and try to solve it. They are calmed and quieted in their souls, and they trust what mama can provide. And that ought to give us some pause about how we make the kinds of applications that we should to this sort of thing. You think about the warnings in this passage. First of all, there is the warning against pride. If we want this kind of contentment, first of all, we get rid of pride. We get rid of this overly high opinion of ourselves. We get rid of an overly low opinion of others. We get rid of this high opinion we have of our activities and our works. Oh, I'm just doing great things. Really? By what standard? And even when we're doing the work of God, we're simply doing it because we're His servants, not because we're these great, impressive people. We do it because we are servants of His. No matter what we're doing, we ultimately need to have a right assessment of ourselves. Over in Romans chapter 12, when the Apostle Paul was talking about using our spiritual gifts in the right way, you know, chapter 12 begins by talking about us making living sacrifices of our bodies. He talks about proving the will of God by our actions. And then starting in verse 3 of Romans 12 and going through verse 8, he talks about properly using our gifts. But how does he talk about using these gifts? He says, "For by the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think with sober judgment, each according to the measure of faith that God has assigned." And that measure of faith he goes on to describe in terms of the spiritual gifts that we have. Whatever gift you have, the first thing you need to remember is God gave it to you. Whatever you have, whatever innate abilities, whatever skill set you have, you were blessed by God with these things. So they didn't originate with you. They originated with God. And for whatever reason, He chose to bless you with those gifts. And I don't care if you got one talent, two talents, three talents, five talents, 10 talents, or 20. It doesn't matter. They all came to you from God, and you are simply a steward of those things. This psalm, as much as anything, is a warning against pride. If you want that childlike spirit, and if you want to give up this tendency that you have to go out and fix everything that you see is wrong, first thing you got to do is properly assess yourself. We need to also, this is also a warning against the wrong kinds of ambition. Pride makes us want to go out and climb mountains and conquer things. And the problem is you get so sidetracked along the way. We used to have some friends of ours when we lived up in Iowa, and it was always funny when we talked about how we did vacations. Of course, at the time we were flat broke, so all of our vacations were as cheap as possible. We had economy vacations. But generally what we tried to do, we learned this pretty early with our kids, we would go someplace, we'd stay, mainly we just tried to do about one thing a day, because we tried we're going to do 20 things a day. That just didn't work. Kids didn't like it. We didn't like it. So we just kind of call it, well, these friends of ours, they were all into conquests. I mean, their vacations, they were going to stop at all the historical markers between Iowa and Alabama, where they were both from. They're going to stop and see every tourist attraction. They're going to stop at every shopping center between, and they'd come back and they'd be exhausted. And every vacation was like that. They're out to conquer mountains. At some point, your ambition catches up with you, and you need to be smart enough to say, you know, I don't need all that. I can be content. I don't have to be ambitious. I don't wrap myself up in these great, prideful things. Can you be content with what God has given you? And can you simply enjoy the scenery along the way as you trust the Lord to provide whatever you need? It is a warning against busyness, just constantly doing things that may or may not have any real significance. Busyness is a big problem for a lot of us. Now, I know that when your kids are growing up, when we first got married, we were pretty content with each other, and then we had Hannah. It's like, oh boy, man, things changed. Then we had Nate. Oh, boy, things have really changed. Then we had Ezra. Oh, man. And with each child, things get busier and busier. And then they get in school. And it's really bad. And then two of them get in school. And then three of them get in school. And then they start driving. And then they get expensive. And then we got two teenagers in school at one time. Oh, man, that was crazy busy and crazy expensive. And then one of them gets in college, and it just keeps getting busier and busier and busier. Young adults with kids, you got to learn the art of saying no to a few things. You realize before long, you just don't have unlimited energy, unlimited time, unlimited money, and unlimited sanity. Somewhere in there, you just got to say, no, we're not doing this anymore. And you got to set some boundaries with your kids, and you got to set some boundaries with the schools, and you got to set boundaries with your friends. Busyness can destroy you. And busyness, I think, is one of those very subtle ways that Satan takes advantage of us. He gets us so wrapped up in busyness, it's hard to be content. Well, there's another thing I need to be doing, is what we say. No, a lot of this stuff you don't need to be doing. You chose it. You chose it. And sometimes we choose poorly. So what we need to do to the very best of our ability is avoid all of this busyness. And sometimes we take pride in that stuff. Sometimes our accomplishments become the trophy case of our lives. And those are things that can rob us of contentment, this childlike trust in the Lord. We're so busy, there is no time for rest, there is no time for quietness. As the saying goes, we need to let go and we need to let God. We need to let go and just let the Lord control our lives from day to day. We need to resist the temptation to be control freaks. We got to control everything. The more you do, the more you put on your plate, the more need there is for control. And not only do we try to control our stuff, we want to control everybody else's stuff too. And boy, that's a headache. That's just a burden. That's something that we humans weren't designed to do very well. Are we willing to let go of some of these things and let the Lord take care of them? I know sometimes as parents, it's very easy to be control freaks with our kids. I understand. I understand that you got to set limits for your kids. I know you have to monitor a lot of things. And kids are not very relaxing. And the older they get, the greater their responsibilities, and sometimes the greater trouble they're capable of getting into. And so you fret about this and you fret about that. But I think there are good ways of doing that. You need to set parameters, you need to enforce them, but at the same time, you can't control everything that everybody does. You need to be sensible in the way that you do that. You need to let go and let God. So this psalm is full of warnings about things that can hinder us from finding that childlike contentment that he describes there in verse 2. I think verse 2 is kind of the centerpiece of the psalm. It says, this is what you're after. But don't forget the connection with verse 1, because verse 1 is describing how we get it. The only way to get it is to let go of these things that rob us of the contentment. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 18, the disciples brought some children to Jesus. They said, who is the greatest in the kingdom? And he called a child to himself. And he put him in the midst of them and said, truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. I know when we study the New Testament and we look at this particular passage, we talk about all the ways that we're like children. But that last line resonates so much with Psalm 131. How did Jesus want us to be like children? He wanted us to be humble. And isn't that what Psalm 131 is talking about? Lord, I am humble because I have learned to get rid of all this excess stuff and this need to control things, this need to accomplish this and that. And Lord, I have learned to be like a child. And David invites us to have that same kind of contentment, but he also tells us what it takes. We've got to be awfully careful that when we are trying to find this contentment, we do it in the way that the Lord has provided for us. If you're here this evening and you've never obeyed the gospel, wouldn't it be wonderful to have this kind of peace, to have this kind of quiet and calm in your life? The only way you can do that is by turning things over to God. That is so hard to do. Again, we're a bunch of control freaks. We want things a certain way. And if we're not willing to let go of things, we will always carry about this burden. There's a song in our songbooks. It's called Dear Lord and Father of Mankind. And there's a verse that says, drop thy still dews of quiet rest till all our striving cease. Take from our souls the strain and stress, and let our ordered lives confess the beauty of thy peace. I love that last line. Let our ordered lives, all of that control freak stuff, we want order in our lives. He says, let go of that. You let go of that, and you find the peace of God. And there is nothing more attractive than that. You can have that if you want it. Think about that while we stand and sing.